Last time in our study, we worked a little bit on the historical background that we had covered the first session. The thing I want to remind you of is that Nineveh was destroyed 6 years before the book of Daniel's first dating here in verse 1. The third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, was the sixth year after the destruction of Nineveh. And that's important in a little while, but just keep that in mind. That's one of the historical issues. Josiah, the dad of Jehoiakim, who, by the way, was named Eliakim, but the king of Egypt renamed him Jehoiakim. And we talked a little bit about that in the first session. We talked about it a little bit more perhaps this evening. But last time we spent some of our time anyway dealing with this issue of what we call literary design. We talked about how the chapters were written. Chapters 1 and 8 through 12 were written in Hebrew, and chapters 2 through 7 were written in the language of the Chaldeans. And we also noted that the chapters, when they're dated, when they say in the first year or the third year Jehoiakim, and the second year Nebuchadnezzar, and the first year Belshazzar, you know, when we look at those dating things, we notice that the chapters are chronologically out of order. Because the chapter 5, which has to do with the story about Belshazzar seeing the handwriting on the wall, he died that night, so that was obviously his last year. So then a little bit later you see in the third year Belshazzar or whatever. And so you know that Daniel is not putting this book together in chronological order. And keep in mind that he didn't write this until the events had transpired. And he was an old man in the last year of the king Belshazzar. But he went on into Darius and then into Cyrus's reign, the Medo-Persians. So he wrote this book around 534. Third year Jehoiakim was 606, 605 B.C. And that issue of writing it in two different languages and then structuring it in a non-chronological way tells us two big things. One of them is he's writing thematically, and the other one is that the repetition in the Chaldean section for chapters 2 and 7, 3 and 6, and 4 and 5 form what we call the chiasm, and that's a literary device. It's designed to tell you what's the most important thing, and the most important thing was chapters 4 and 5, which were the conversion of Nebuchadnezzar and the destruction of Belshazzar, his grandson. So when we study those chapters, we'll see more about that. But we said that we thought that the main message of the book is the declaration that God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. That's a statement right out of the book of James. But it seems to fit the information that's in the book of Daniel. Except that an enormous part of the book of Daniel is prophetic, and we're going to be talking about that some more tonight. So that's where we've been. And all that was basically background staging for our study of the details. So this evening, we're actually going to start looking at the details. So as we get started here, I want us to look at the focus and facts that are in these first two verses, because in a very real sense, the first two verses are the introduction to the whole book. And it's characteristic of introductions that they lay the groundwork for some of the major issues in the rest of the book. That's what introductions are supposed to do. They're supposed to introduce you to and then develop whatever you've been introduced to. So the statement in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. And that's what we're going to look at this evening, these details. Now, when we look at a statement like these two sentences, actually, verses 1 and 2, we ask ourselves, what is he talking about, and what's he saying about what he's talking about? What's the point? And one of the ways we can discover that is, again, the literary design, the way he says things. If I had written verses 1 and 2 in English class when I was in the ninth grade, my teacher would have written, redundant. Why? Because I was saying the same thing over and over. That's what redundant means. It's unnecessary. Well, one of the issues in these two verses is the number of things that are repeated over and over. For example, it says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. So what is this king of Judah business? I mean, he's told us Jehoiakim's king of Judah in verse 1. Therefore, it's unnecessary to say it again in verse 2, except that it's necessary for emphasis. And that means that there's something really significant about this king of Judah thing that we want to understand. And then there's also this issue of verse 2, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Now there you have the Lord and God and God and God, all in one verse. Three references to God and one to the Lord. So you have this focus on the fluctuating use of God, or gods, because one of them's capital G and the other, of course, little g. And then you have this house business. The vessels of the house of God brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and then he took them into the treasury of his God. So there's another repetition. So we have several things that are going around and around here, focusing on some issues that we need to be thinking about. So I want to start with the repetition of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Now, I already told you that Jehoiakim, oh, and by the way, Jehoiakim being the name that Pharaoh of Egypt gave him is significant in the rest of this chapter, because Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah in chapter 1 are given names by Nebuchadnezzar so that they become Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel's name is Belteshazzar. It has a little T-E. Belshazzar is the king, and Belteshazzar is Daniel. So the whole idea of the name changing, the king of Egypt, whose name was Necho in ECO, they call him in some translations Pharaoh Necho, because Pharaoh is the king of Egypt and Necho is his name. He changed Jehoiakim's name from Eliakim to Jehoiakim. And he didn't do that just because. He did that on purpose, just like Nebuchadnezzar is going to do it to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And invariably, there are two things going on. One of them is, from the beginning of Genesis, where God brings all of the created animals and stuff before Adam to find out what he would name them, and whatever he named them, that's what they were. The whole issue there of giving a name something meant that you would be in dominion over it. So all the animal kingdom was subject to Adam because he had given them their names. And it was a statement by God that he was going to allow Adam to be kind of like a sub-sovereign over the creation. God would be the God over it, but he had put Adam and Eve over the earth, the creation. And the naming business was part of that. Well, that became kind of a accepted cultural thing through many cultures. So when Pharaoh changed Eliakim's name to Jehoiakim, he was making a deliberate statement. And that statement was, you're my man. You'll do what I tell you. You're in subjection to me. And the second thing that's significant about name changing is what it meant before it was changed and what it meant after it was changed. Because if you've recently read about Jacob and his two wives and two concubines and how all these women got all these kids, all of them boys except one. Every time Leah had a child, she gave a reason for the name she was given that was connected to the conflict she had with her sister, because she was the unloved one and Rachel was the loved one. So it's highly significant, I think, that when you follow that through, you have Reuben and Simeon and Levi. Well, Reuben, she says Reuben was named Reuben because God saw that she was unloved. But when you get to Levi, who is the third one, she names him Levi, and her reason is because surely now my husband will love me. Well, what's this surely now? Well, Rachel hasn't been having any kids. She's barren. But Leah's thinking is typical Jewish Hebrew thinking. Third time's a charm. She didn't get her husband's love on the first one. She didn't get her husband's love on the second one. But when she had three boys in a row, she said, surely now, third time's a charm. And by the way, that explains why Paul prayed three times for the thorn to be removed. If you ask three times and you don't get it, you might as well pray about something else. Third time's a charm. If it doesn't work, then it's not going to work. That's kind of the way they thought. And it's interesting that she named him Levi because she thought that by having three sons, she would actually be able to get her husband to love her by her performance. And guess who Levi was? He was the head of the priesthood of a system that says you can get God's approval by your performance. It's all about performance. And that's why the Jews were so legalistic, because their whole theology was on demand performance. If you ask a Jew how to get along with God, they'd say, do what you're told. Obey him. Well, good luck with that. Surely you can get along with him if you obey him. The problem is not whether that'll work. The problem is whether you can obey him consistently enough for him to be pleased with your behavior. And of course, Paul says, you can't. All the sin, you're not going to get approval from God by performance. You're going to get it by when you start believing him. So all of that is background for this issue of the change of name. And it's really interesting that Eliakim's original name was that the word El in the Eliakim, the word El at the beginning is the formal name for the word God in the Old Testament when it's not the dual. The dual form of El is Elohim. But El simply means executive power. And so the word Eliakim meant that the executive power, creator of all that is, the powerful, omnipotent God, establishes things. And that name, the king's name, meant that he was depending on El to establish his rule and all that kind of stuff. Well, the Pharaoh had a god too that he called El. And in a very real sense, his El was greater than, you know, my daddy's stronger than your daddy. My El is bigger than your El, and it's proven because I just defeated you in battle. So he changed his name from El will establish to Yah will establish, which was a shortened version of Yahweh. And he did that because the Jews' God's name was Yahweh. Well, did he do it because he had any respect for Yahweh? No. He did it because he was snubbing Jehoiakim. He was saying, Eliakim, ha! You should be named Jehoiakim, because that's your God's name, and he didn't establish it. But we're going to stick you with that title or name. Well, in a very real sense, that's the same thing that's going on later in the chapter, and we'll get back to it when we get there. And by the way, we're not just going to go two verses at a time, I don't think. But we did spend a couple weeks on background, and now we're looking at the introduction, and then we'll perhaps move a little faster. But no promises. The issue then of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, is that this man has been demeaned by the Pharaoh of Egypt with a name change. And this man is the king of Judah. And that's significant, as I said earlier, because it's been only 6 years since the king of Assyria was defeated and Nineveh was destroyed. And that's significant because 110 years prior to that, Nineveh had carried away the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom, Israel. So when it repeats, king of Judah, it's deliberately reminding us that this is not the king, this is not the Davidic king of the whole nation of Israel. This is the king of the 2.5 tribes that survived, the Davidic house in the south. The 10.5 tribes have been carried away captive because of their persistent ungodliness, and the king of Assyria took them off in captivity. But then God turned around and judged the king, the Assyrians, for their treatment of Israel. And that's what actually happened just 6 years before this book starts. So it's fresh in their mind. And in a sense, the statement that in the third year of the king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, besieged it, and the Lord gave him into his hand. That's a shock statement. Because if you have the 10 and a half tribes of the northern kingdom disappeared 110 years ago, nobody's ever heard of them since. They've never returned. There's never been any. There's no. We don't even know where they got put, is what the Jews would tell you in Judah. But now, Judah has been besieged and dominated by the king of Babylon. And you have to begin to wonder. The same thing that I challenged you last week with is what do faithful believers do when God has made promises to the larger corporate group, the nation, but the nation's apostate? They've turned away from God. So in order to carry out his commitments to discipline the wayward nation, what happens to these people that, you know, they're doing what's right? And that's exactly where Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah are. They're the ones who are paying the price, in a very real sense, for what the wicked in the nation have done. Now, when Nebuchadnezzar came in this third year of Jehoiakim, there wasn't a big captivity at that point. Because if you read the books of 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, Jehoiakim reigned in Judah for 11 years. And this is third year. So there's still 8 years to go in his reign. And then he rebelled against Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar came back then, and that's when he really destroyed Jerusalem and took in a whole bunch of captives and basically emptied the land, carried it off. So what we're looking at here is this shock value of being told that now Judah's in the same danger that Israel had been in. What's going to happen now to the people of God, to the people of Yahweh? The other kings of the other nations have their own gods, and those kings all argue on the basis of the idea that God means executive power, that if we can defeat you in battle, our God's bigger than your God. And isn't that what Sennacherib said to Hezekiah? Don't let the king tell you that your God's going to deliver you, because none of these other nations' gods have delivered them from us. Of course, that's where you make your big mistake, is when you start yammering about how superior you are to God. And there were a whole lot of Assyrians that were killed by the angel of the Lord on the basis of that challenge. But the point here is that we still have this suggestion at the very beginning of the book that the covenant that God made with David, that he would have a kingdom that would last forever. God told David, David said, I'm going to build a house for God. And God said, no, you're not, but I'm going to build you a house, and it'll be a kingdom that lasts forever. Well, how long is forever? The king of Babylon has just come and besieged Jerusalem, and the Lord gave him into their hand. That's kind of a shock. So this whole issue is rooted in the issues of the repetition of the king of Judah, king of Judah. This is Judah at risk. And Judah is the house of David. And that puts the promises of God to David at risk. At least it looks like it does. And by the way, there's a story later on in the record of the kings and stuff of Israel. One of those kings, and I forget now, maybe it was in Jeremiah 22. There is a king in Jeremiah 22 who is of the lineage of Solomon. He is of the lineage of And by the way, remember, Jeremiah was a prophet to the ones that were still in the land after Daniel and his friends had been carried away. So Jeremiah is a contemporary of Daniel. But the Lord says to this Solomonic king, the one who is in the regnal line of the Davidic throne, he said, I am fed up with you. If you were a signet ring on my finger, I would take you off and throw you away. And he said, write down this man childless. His offspring will not sit on the throne of David forever. You know what that sounds like? It sounds like he just cut off the Davidic throne. And that's really interesting because he had promised David a house that would endure forever. And the solution to that is not given until we get to the book of Matthew and Luke and the New Testament. Because in the Gospel of Matthew, the introduction of the book is, this is the beginning of the generation of Jesus Christ. Well, the generation of Jesus Christ means his background. And so when you read the genealogy that's listed in Matthew chapter 1, it goes down through Solomon. And it comes to Joseph, who was the husband of Mary. And since God had told, is that?
Jeconiah.
But also Jeconiah. Okay, he had said to Coniah, none of his offspring are going to sit on the throne of David from here on, period. Well, Joseph was a descendant of Jeconiah. But that was the regnal line. So Joseph was the legitimate heir of the throne of David, and he was a carpenter in Nazareth. But when you read in Luke, where you have the genealogy given, it shifts. When you get to David, it doesn't go to Solomon, it goes to Nathan. And then it goes down through there and it comes out to Mary. And that's the reason why you have the virgin birth. Jesus gets his genetic connection to David through Nathan and Mary, but he gets his regnal right through his father Joseph, because the right was Joseph's. Even though God had cut him off, that was the regnal line. So he was the legitimate heir to the throne. And because he was Mary's husband and Jesus was her son, his assumption of Jesus as his son made him the regnal heir. So he was a legitimate king. He was also the seed of David. But God cut the male part of that off. He said, can't have my son being born of Adam in the male sense. Because the sin problem came through Adam. And if Jesus had had the genetic link to Adam as a man, he would have been born in sin just like the rest of them. Couldn't have that. So God took the genetic material from the egg that Mary had, and he fertilized it and made Mary pregnant by the Holy Spirit so that Jesus didn't have the male part of the, what do you call that, DNA? He had the human DNA from Mary, but he didn't have the male part of that human DNA. And that kept him from being born as a sinner. And that makes him the blameless, sinless Lamb of God. So, all that to say that there are indications in the first two verses of this book that we're going to be running into some issues about what do faithful people do when the promises of God seem to be being eliminated by what's happening. Because who eliminated the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, according to verse 2? The Lord did. Nebuchadnezzar came and besieged Jerusalem, but there had been kings that came to Jerusalem before and besieged it. You remember there were, 700,000 soldiers destroyed overnight by the Lord. The armies rustled through the trees and they fought one another and killed off. There were hundreds of thousands of soldiers destroyed. God could have done that here, but he wasn't going to, and you remember why?
490 years.
Because they had ignored the sabbatic years until they had actually created a 70-year debt to the land. They owed the land 70 years of rest. It took them 490 years or something like that to get there. And the reason why I say or something like that, because the sabbatical years, there were eight of them every 50 years, because you had the seven on the sevens, and then the year Jubilee, which followed the seventh seven, was also a sabbatical year. So you had eight every 50 years. But anyway, it was over 400 years that they had just ignored God's Sabbath requirement. And don't forget, the Sabbath was the sign of the old covenant. If you ignored that, you were just in effect saying, I don't care about this whole covenant. I'm not interested. And that's the ultimate statement of disbelief. So it's the high crime. So that's what's going on with this house of Judah, this king of Judah. And then you also have this fluctuating identity in relation to verse 2, where the Lord, that word is Adonai, and it basically is used whenever you're talking about the person who has the authority to make the decisions. It's not so much the issue of El, which is executive power, but it's the authority. For example, Jesus said on one occasion that no man could take his life from him. He had the power to lay it down, and he had the power to come back. He said, this authority I've received from my Father. So the word Adonai had to do with the ability to make the decisions. He was the authority. So they would use that word Lord of the leaders of a household. They were the ones who made the decisions. They would use that word of kings when it came to decision-making kind of thing. And so you have the word Adonai in verse 2 as a decision-making. The king of Babylon was serving a little g god, an El, an executive power. But the scriptures identify those little g's as idols, idols and demons, which means they're created beings, okay? So in the term of executor of power, executive power, how much power does a creature have in comparison to the infinity of God and omnipotence? There is no comparison. You can have a guy like me who has very little power. Or you can take the governor of Louisiana in terms of his decision-making ability and the execution of power. He's the chief executive officer of the state of Louisiana. He can make a lot of heavy-duty decisions, affect a lot of people. Well, the president of the United States can do that. And so in terms of relative power, you can go up to the angelic majesties, those forces of darkness that run amok in the heavenlies. And they have a lot of power, angelic power. But all of those are creature powers. And creature powers compared to uncreated, infinite omnipotence is nothing. So the decision for Nebuchadnezzar to be able to besiege and subdue Jerusalem was not Nebuchadnezzar's or his gods. It was the Lord who gave him in to the hand of the king of Babylon. That's the first reference to God outside of the name and the name change in verse 1. The first reference to God is the term Lord. And then it says, he gave not only Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, but he gave some of the vessels of the house of God. And this is Elohim, and this is the capital G God. This is the vessels of the temple that Solomon built. And he, that is Nebuchadnezzar, brought them to the land of Shinar to the house of his God, which was Baal, or they had several gods in Babylon.
Why would a conquering king only take some of the vessels? I mean, it seemed like he had took everything.
Well, he did 8 years later.
Yeah.
When Jehoiakim rebelled against him, then they did. They demolished Jerusalem. And it was lying in ruins. That's Nehemiah and Ezra.
Right.
The whole city was destroyed. The temple was destroyed. And then they did. They took it all. But apparently in this third year of Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't really interested in just destroying the Jews. He wanted a loyal vassal state. because it's on the outward perimeters of his empire, and he wanted a loyal vassal state out there to kind of be the military thing for that area for him. But when you have your vassal rebel, well then... But it's really interesting that the issue of the vessels and the reference to God, he says the Lord, the house of God, he brought them to the house of his God, and then he brought them in, he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. So you have capital G God, you have little g and little g God, and you have Lord. So four references to God in this one verse obviously means that there's something big going on here. The whole idea here is that it is a matter of focus, that the book of Daniel has to do with the Gentiles' arrogance in their little g God theologies in contrast to Yahweh, who is the God above all gods. He's the high king of heaven. The heaven of heaven, Solomon said, couldn't contain him, let alone this temple that I've built. So that's one of the big issues, and of course that's the issue when Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are going to get thrown in the fiery furnace. Because what does Nebuchadnezzar say to them? What God is there that can deliver you out of my hand? Making himself bigger than God. So that's part of what this introduction is all about. But then thirdly, you have this vessels of the house of God. And this is a repetition of the house of God business, which is the temple. And what goes on at the temple? Well, that's where the nation of Judah worships Elohim, the true God. They're supposed to be worshiping the true God. But it's all facade. It's all been perverted and twisted. Josiah had brought the nation of Judah back to the worship of Yahweh, but he was killed by Pharaoh Necho in battle. And so then Eliakim's brother took the throne of Judah, but he only lasted about 3 months. And then Pharaoh put Jehoiakim in his place, or Eliakim in his place, and renamed him Jehoiakim. So all of that's going on here, but the point is that there is a huge issue of the book that has to do with the worship of the true God. And God, the true God, is making it difficult because he's the one who turns his nation of Judah over to Nebuchadnezzar. Doesn't he know that Nebuchadnezzar's going to go blowing smoke about how much greater his God is than Judah's God? Doesn't he know that? Sure he does. Well, doesn't he know that it's going to be a serious problem for people to say, well, how do I know my God's the true God if our armies get defeated by another army and their God? And it becomes a stumbling block for many people, especially when they don't have any interest in walking with the true God anyway. And Judah had proven they didn't have that interest by their refusal to operate under the Constitution that God had given them. So the vessels issue actually brings the issue of worship right into the issue here. This is the bottom line to the entire book of Daniel, is the deliberate, committed worship of the true God of heaven. That's the issue. And when Nebuchadnezzar refuses to do that, God disciplines him, makes him think he's an animal living out in the pasture for 7 years until his understanding returns to him and his eyes are open and he realizes that he's been chasing the wrong God, been worshiping the wrong God. And I don't think there's any doubt at all that Nebuchadnezzar was converted by that. But his grandson, who witnessed all of that, is Belshazzar. And he's the one who takes these vessels out of the house of his God and brings them into his palace to have his big drunken orgy with all of his higher-ups in his empire, because they've all been reduced to Babylon, and the armies outside of them, the Medo-Persian armies, have surrounded Babylon. But Babylon's got a river that runs under the wall and through the city and out from under the other wall. So they've got water. They don't have to worry about ever running out of water. And they had a wall that was, I forget the dimensions, I'll get it when we get to that part of it, but it was wide enough at the top that you could run four chariots along beside each other. And for an army to get over that wall was basically impossible. And so they felt very secure in there. And that's why they were having this big, it was kind of a feel-good orgy bash to make all of the people kind of relaxed about being surrounded by these armies out there, because they had food for years to come and they had water running under the city for years to come. And then this hand starts writing on the wall. Well, the reason the hand was writing on the wall is because it says that Belshazzar brought the vessels of the house of the true God of heaven, the vessels that were used to worship the true God of heaven. He brought them in there to drink out of them and get drunk out of them and have his feast. That is as blatant a rejection of the most fundamental requirement upon any creature that you can ever do. When a creature is created, he has an automatic bound responsibility to serve his God. God created him to be his servant. That's an automatic necessity placed on all creatures. Just because humanity doesn't accept that makes absolutely no difference, the obligations on them. And in the judgment of the great day, God's going to basically challenge everything they did against one standard. Were you worshiping me when you did that? But there's one more thing here, and that is the fact that the big question in verse 2 is the identity of the true God. And what is everybody saying? You can identify the true God by the demonstrations of power. That's what they're all saying. My God's the true God because I just defeated you in battle. You came in under the banner of your God, and I came in under the banner of mine, and I won. So your God's less powerful than my God is. And when you push that theologically and rationally, it makes a lot of sense. You can identify the true God because, bottom line, how is everything going to finally come out at the end? On the basis of what? Power. The one that's got the power is going to take the day. And in the judgment of the great white throne, the people that are cast in the lake of fire are going to be cast there because they refuse to kneel to the one powerful God who's capable of consigning them to the lake of fire, brooking no arguments. In other words, if you've got the power, you're the God. And how do we know that Jesus was the Son of God? Romans chapter 1. He was declared to be the Son of God by the resurrection from the dead. Power. All right? However, there is this problem that in the situation with the house of Judah as well as the house of Israel, the old argument that you identify God by his power doesn't hold. If you've read through the book of Isaiah any time recently, you realize that in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah has a burden to establish the identity of the true God. And what's he appeal to? It's not the battlefield. According to Isaiah, multiple times, and one of them is Isaiah 44:7. Well, verse 6 says, "Thus says the Lord, the King of Israel and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first and I am the last, and there is no God besides me." Okay, any God can say that. How do you know your God's the one? I mean, there are gods running all over the place in the minds and hearts of people. So, verse 7, "Who is like me? Let him proclaim and declare it. Let him recount it to me in order. From the time that I established the ancient nation, let them declare to them the things that are coming and the events that are going to take place." In other words, it's not omnipotence. It's omniscience revealed in prophecy. This is a real heavy-duty issue for Daniel. because Daniel is notoriously prophetic. Starts out from the get-go with Nebuchadnezzar having a dream, and he wants somebody to interpret it. And so Daniel says, well, I'll give you an interpretation. Give me 24 hours. And he goes and asks the God of heaven to reveal the dream and what it means. And the dream, he recounts, and then he tells him what it means, and it's all prophetic. It's all about the way the future of the world's going to develop. And so in the book of Daniel, you're actually picking up the what we call the apologetic for the identity of the one true God. And that apologetic is, if you can find somebody who can tell you what's going to happen before it happens, if he can tell you from the beginning what the end's going to be, when you get to the end and it actually comes to pass exactly like you were told in the beginning, you know that you have been confronted by the true God. Omniscience makes it impossible to escape. So it's not power on the battlefield, because under the divine constitution that God had made with Israel, he had warned them about what would happen if they didn't obey the constitution. They didn't obey the law. They didn't go by the rules and regulations. If they didn't worship at the tabernacle like they were supposed to, he told them, there'll be cursings on you and other nations will come in and you'll sow and they'll eat. So he had warned them that the national warfare issues that would be involved in a nation living in a fallen world surrounded by other nations where there's conflict. I mean, why did he tell David he couldn't build a temple?
He was a man of war
and bloodshed. He said, "Nah, David, you're not the man to build this. I'll let your son build it. But I'm going to build you a house," he told David. Well, the whole point there is that the issue of who wins on the battlefield, it really isn't about your God and my God. It's about the God deciding who's going to win. And it says in verse 2, the Lord gave him into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. So it wasn't Nebuchadnezzar's God that determined that. But how do you see that in reality? I mean, when you're the one who going out to fight with the other army, you don't see prophecy being fulfilled to tell you whose God's the true God. That takes time to develop. But Isaiah's polemic is, if you can identify a God who can tell you from the beginning what the ending's going to be, you found the right one. And that's how God identifies himself in Isaiah multiple times. Who is like me can tell you the end from the beginning. So in the book of Daniel, where we have a book of full of prophecy, just full of it, you have this statement that the true God is the God of Judah. The true God's the God of the house of Judah.
What you're basically saying is, we are totally blessed because God has revealed himself to us. We'd very easily be running around with the rest of the world trying to figure out who's the true God.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just the grace of God that we know.
Absolutely. This is the, Paul said about the Jews in Romans, he said, well, if the Jews are just as bad as the Gentiles, and that's Romans 1, 2, and 3, well, then what advantage does the Jew have? And he says, much in many ways, the first thing they have is the oracles of God, the words of God. Because it's in the words that God, a vast portion of this entire book was prophetic when it was given, when the words were given. A whole lot of the stuff that's in here was prophetic. That's why they call them the prophets. God was a prophecy-speaking God during all of Israel's history up until Malachi. In Malachi, he uttered the prophecy, I'm going to send my servant, Elijah, before the great day of the Lord comes. And then there was silence for 450 years. And then John the Baptizer comes on the scene and everybody says, well, he's a prophet of God. And lo and behold, Jesus said, well, if you can bear it, he is Elijah. And he said it that way on purpose. Because there is a difference between being Elijah and being in the spirit and form of Elijah. John the Baptist wasn't technically Elijah. Elijah's coming back.
Yeah, but he was a voice calling the wilderness.
He was a fulfillment of the same type of meaning as Elijah. So Jesus could say, yeah, he's Elijah, in the sense that that's the meaning. But in terms of the actual person, Elijah was caught up into the third heaven, and he's there now, and he's waiting to be sent back here.
Amen.
He's coming back before Jesus does.
Could we also interpret that? I mean, he was at the Transfiguration.
Elijah?
Yeah. Elijah and Moses.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
he was there.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why many people think that the two prophets in the book of Revelation are Moses and Elijah. But I don't think Moses is going to be there. I think it's going to be Enoch and Elijah, because they were the two men who were taken out of this world without dying, and they're going to be coming back. But you're right in terms of the exposure. It says in Mark 9 that Jesus' garments were transformed, and Elijah appeared to them with Moses, and they were talking to Jesus. But I don't think that that means that in the future it's going to be Elijah and Moses. I believe it's going to be. Enoch was a prophet of the second coming, according to Jude. Because Jude says that Enoch said, I saw the Lord coming with 10,000s of his holy ones to execute judgment upon all the ungodly. Well, when's that going to be? It's going to be at the end when Jesus comes back and executes all the wicked.
I always wondered how Peter and John, all of them, knew that they were Elijah and Moses. I mean, they didn't have a family album. It was like pictures. They were still preaching.
Yeah, and that's one of those areas where the scriptures just don't tell us all the details. Because, yeah, it's curious. How did they know it was Moses and Elijah? But because the book is inspired by the Spirit of God, I have to believe they were Moses and Elijah. And how they knew it, I don't know.
It's just like, you know, they just pop up, oh, let's build three temples.
Well, the point that I want to make this evening is that the very introduction, the first two verses of the book of Daniel, the issues are God and the worship of the true God and the condition of Judah in terms of the apostasy in Judah under Jehoiakim and God's displeasure with their rebellion and how God turns them over to Nebuchadnezzar as a disciplinary issue. At that time, they didn't know it was for 70 years. That was a prophecy that Jeremiah told them about, and Daniel read it. And that's when he knew it was going to be 70 years long. But that's basically the introduction of the whole book, because the whole book swirls around, who is the true God and are you going to yield to him or not? And the proof that he's the true God is the whole book of all of the prophecies that are made. And enough of them have already happened in history that we don't have to worry about whether the rest of them are going to be, because they are. I mean, if you can nail it, if you got 1,000 things to say about the end from the beginning, or these not quite to the end, if you can nail it on 800 of them, you don't have to worry about the last 200. They're going to happen. So the book of Daniel stands as one of the strongest arguments that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is the true God, and Christianity is the follow-through on what that God did for us in Christ, because he anointed him to be both Lord and Christ.